just human beings, and we are all part of the system, and it takes all of us to grow. So the resistance to trying to divide us, no, I'm not surprised in it. I'm actually encouraged, and I'm just happy that everybody's starting to come together and have that full circle.
That's NFL star Michael Bennett. He plays defensive end for the Seattle Seahawks, speaking to us from Honolulu, Hawaii. Michael Bennett recently pulled out of an Israeli government-sponsored trip to Israel for NFL players. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottes, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cable Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at KBOO.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Dance and Resist. Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist will be a part of the Open Signal Open House event and will be the first broadcast of the new dance party television show featuring Kelly Danger of KBOO's Midnight Highway. This will be a space that is safe to dance for issues that we care about, self-care, and radical social change. Costumes are encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal Portland Community Media Center, 2766 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world you cast your vote.
Good morning. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO in Portland. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lynn. I'm here with...
And I'm Adi.
Yeah! And this morning, we are so pleased to have our guest, Michael Mead, who is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. His live events, by the way, are pretty life-changing and affirming events. I recommend you go to one when next time he's in town. He's the author of The Genius Myth, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, The Water of Life, Initiation and Tempering of the Soul, editor with James Hillman and Robert Bly of Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, and editor of Crossroads, A Quest for Contemporary Rites of Passage. He's the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, which is a nonprofit network of artists, activists, and community builders that encourage understanding between diverse communities. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Well, you know, it's another morning in the world in conflict.
So. Oh, geez. I've been reading all the essays that you've been writing lately, and I've just been blown away, though I still am energized about the resistance that we need for the amount of lies and fear coming out of this administration. We had two activists with the Latino community on last week, and I just didn't realize, you know, I'm a white woman. This affects me. It hasn't affected me as deeply as immigrant communities, and the amount of fear these folks are under, that, you know, kids are afraid to go to school because their parents won't be there when they get home. Just a daily terrorizing.
Yeah.
And I just sort of wanted to talk about that because I feel that, well, first of all, it's ugly.
And the sphere of terror is expanding so much. I mean, it's like the immigrant communities from many different countries, pretty much any country that means that you're not white, looking at first Muslims coming from specific countries, whether they had green cards or not, whether they, you know, well, actually, I take it back. There was a couple of white folks caught up in that, like the fellow from the ex-prime minister of Sweden. A government official from Europe that had, gotten caught somewhere because he was had traveled to Iran recently, and that had popped up on. So there's, you know, but there's that terror, then the terror of the deportations and the instability with ICE coming into many different Latino communities across the country in what looked like a really big coordinated sweep just a couple weeks back. And now, you know, we're looking at targeting transgender people, specifically transgender folks who are students,
or want to use a bathroom,
any trans person wants to use a bathroom, and we're just sort of like waiting for who's the next target. So that bubble of fear is expansive at this point, and it's affecting more and more people. And we're only, 5 weeks into this administration. So it's like, where are the sites going to be set next?
What we're saying is, what ideas do you have about how to handle this fear and not let people be consumed by it and somehow use it in a way? I mean, it's easy to say for me. It's not as easy for people of the Latino community who are afraid of being deported every day, but...
Yeah, I mean, the white privilege exists and will continue unless you go against, the rulership, and then, or you're a member of the media, then even if you're white, you're going to be thrown into the pot of those who don't belong from this really narrow. A couple of weeks ago, I was meeting with Luis Rodriguez, Latino poet and activist, and we've worked together for years, and that's what he was talking about. He said he'd never seen so much fear in the Latino community, and it's affecting everyone in the community. And, the old story, I think, applies, that at first they go for the black people, or at first they go for the gay people, then the trans people, and then so on. In other words, there's an old story I've been thinking about a lot called The Cannibal King. And in this case, it's a king. I keep thinking about king because I don't think Donald Trump thinks he's the president. I think he thinks he's the emperor. And
with no clothes.
And the one without clothes.
Yeah.
the name Donald means he who would rule over everyone. That's what the name means, the origin of the name. And so he's been in this fantasy since he was a little overprivileged child. And nothing has changed that in 70 years somehow. So a couple of things about it. One is, I think we've elected the symptom of the culture also. In other words, he represents this kind of American presumption of superiority, which now is completely challenged by a world in radical change. And so so both, I think, there's fear at the root of what's happening, and then there's fear-mongering in order to try to take control and keep control. But in the story of the Cannibal King, what happens is a king happens to get accidentally a taste of human flesh in his soup. And once he tastes that, he wants more and more of it and forces the, you know, the royal cook to keep finding people to throw into the soup, that, and then they get devoured. And what the people around that Cannibal King don't realize is eventually they'll go into the soup as well. And so that tells you one of the big mistakes the Republican Party has made, because someone like Donald Trump, who is just, you know, a roaring narcissist, has no capacity to care for anyone else, and that includes his own inner circle and the Republican Party. And so those kind of stories just help me understand, you know, what might be happening psychologically. And you mentioned the emperor without clothes, and the oldest version I can find of that story, the emperor in that case is actually afraid that he's illegitimate. And the pretensions that he's going through are to cover up his own inner sense of illegitimacy. And that points directly to the narcissistic kind of disorder. And so making Latino people, making immigrants, making Muslims, making trans people, making all these people illegitimate is really the projection out of this deep, deep illegitimacy that's in this, you know, this man that's been elevated to the top. And so that's not going to stop. I don't think there's any way he can stop it. As everybody has by now noticed, there is no pivot. If someone is so deeply anchored in narcissism, they're also secretly anchored in self-loathing. And they cannot pivot from that position, but they can kind of project that self-loathing out into the world. And so we're all going to suffer that. And in a certain sense, I guess I'm imagining it's also a kind of elevating of the underlying problems in American culture. That is to say, America always claiming it's the best, it's always been the best, the greatest culture in the history of the world, all that kind of collective narcissism is now elevated to the top. And I think, painful and scary as it is, it's also the opportunity to really battle it out for both the underlying real dream of America, the dream of freedom that includes everybody, and the dream of a bigger imagination of life, and also it's the opportunity to kind of fight our way out of this delusion that life is simply about economics and politics, and back to the ground of human nature, which is to be connected to nature and be connected to a creative culture. But I think it's actually now about to be a fairly long pitched struggle.
Though I've never seen people quite as, you know, I've heard folks talk about, well, how are we going to not be exhausted? But the absurdity and the outright lies, and they never, these folks never try to, and I really include Steve Bannon right in the top of this too. In some ways, you know, Trump is his puppet. As far as I'm concerned, he is. I don't quite know how to describe his evil, but it's not minor. And I've never seen people quite so energized, and they seem to be sticking to it.
Well, for one thing, I think all the spokespeople have an affinity for this narcissistic disorder.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see when they speak, they don't double down, they triple down. And you can sometimes see in the glazed look in the eyes that they have to be right, even though they secretly also know they're lying. So I think there's a shared affinity for this kind of deep illegitimacy of the self. And the only way they can feel powerful is, like anybody with a big narcissistic problem, it is to constantly get reinforcement and reinforce their own sense of empowerment. And I agree with you, though. I think Steve Bannon is the exception. I think when I was watching the campaign and all, only one seemed unimpressed by Donald Trump. I don't think he is impressed by Trump. I think he has much bigger fish that he's trying to fry. And I think that has to do with the more international alt-right. And so sometimes it's both scary and helpful to imagine that Trump is just one of the people playing this role around the world. And it's happening even in Holland. There's now a big alt-right movement with someone, you know, rising to the top of the political sphere by being, you know, very right-wing. And honestly, I think the reason it's so widespread is because everybody is truly facing huge problems that are not easily solved. And I mean climate change and social justice issues that are very complicated and very involved and tricky. And I think there's an underlying sense of despair that some people are turning into the opportunity to rule through fear. In other words, there's very big background issues that, I don't know, it's hard to even talk about or hard to get a lot of people to talk about. And the difficulty of those and perhaps the fear that we can't solve those is creating these pretend strong men and strong women. Actually, if you go to France, you find it there too. So just big idea stuff sometimes helps me. In other words, it's unbelievable the forcefulness of this. It's also unbelievable the callousness of it. And then I think of a very old idea, which is we're all the living people, we're all the descendants of people who survived. And humanity has survived, the old idea says, by two capacities. One, the ability to be tough, and the other, the ability to be tender and caring. In other words, there are times in a survival moment where someone might have to tough it out or become very tough. And then there are times when it's the tender-hearted, open-minded, open-hearted qualities of humanity that are actually the root of survival. And what's happening in a sense here is a bunch of people are just going to pretend that being tough is the solution. And so that means it requires the rest of us to stay close to the imagination that being open-minded and open-hearted is, in fact, a way to survival. Being inclusive is a way for human survival as much as being tough in some moments might be.
Well, in your essay, Inauguration Signs and Symbols, you write, there are times when it becomes necessary for well-intentioned people to take a stand for something genuine in their own lives. Standing for the deeper truths in life and speaking truth to power are antidotes that can reverse the toxic course of extreme arrogance, excessive greed, and needless exploitation. This is the time to make acts of truth wherever the environment is threatened, wherever tyranny tries to rule, wherever power tries to dominate over love. And it's that last line that really just hit me when I was reading it. And again, so that's wherever tyranny tries to rule, wherever power tries to dominate over love. You also write, there's no time for cynicism or giving in to despair. And that's, you know, what I'm most, I'll admit, that's the thing that frightens me, is that, you know, here we are 36 days into this, you know, admin, and the amount of hurt, the amount of fear, the amount of, I guess we'll just leave it with hurt and fear right now. I'm afraid people are going to shut down and not actively find that tenderness, not find the love, not actually connect with what feeds their heart not to connect with each other, but to shut down, to become isolated. And that is, you know, the path towards absolute destruction.
I couldn't agree more. And the tendency to isolate is also driven by fear. Fear that if I step out there, I'll get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, fear that fear of overwhelm. And so there has to be some root ideas and root imagination that give us the courage to take courageous stances when possible. And so, in a sense, the antidote to a massive campaign of falseness is being true to oneself. So, yes, resistance, direct political resistance, is extremely important. And some people find their courage in that, in being with other people. By the way, the you know, kind of, you know, arch correctness of the Women's March right after the inauguration was the move of tenderness against pretend toughness. In other words, instinctively, that was the right place to come from. And we have to keep finding those right places. But I'm remembering back in the 60s, you know, I grew up during that and was involved in all kinds of demonstrations. And one of the things I learned in the middle of the demonstrations is that there's two things happening at once. One is the collective response, you know, that is grassroots. In other words, something from the ground below people. Because you have the government and the country. You have the nation and the land. And there are times when stuff comes right up from under the land, from the heart of the earth. And that creates the actual grassroots movement, which is a collective thing, which is happening again now, first time really since the 60s. But in the middle of the collective movement is almost the initiatory opportunity for someone to awaken to who they are on this earth. And in other words, it's either isolate in fear or step into the path of a greater truth for oneself. That's a real option. And there's no sense calling someone else completely false if I'm not living some of my own truth. And so one of the things I surprisingly learned in the 60s is to be part of a meaningful collective group trying to create more freedom, more justice, but also then to find out who I am in the midst of that, who I am individually. And so, again, I'd say it's a danger opportunity situation, and I understand the fear that would make us isolate or retreat, but I think the growth and the kind of payoff is taking risks that the soul wants to take. I often think of that little story from Africa, the way they used to teach young people in Africa that in the plains, the lions are always going to be hunting the gazelles or some similar kind of animal that move in a herd. And the way the lions do it is they take the old lions who don't have teeth but can roar loudly, and they put them on one side, and then the younger lions wait on the other side. And when the herds come through, the lions start roaring, and so all of the herds run the opposite direction, and they run right into the younger lions that are going to devour them. And so when they're using the teaching story, they say to people, run towards the roar. Because
and they're usually female lions, too, that are doing the hunting.
Yeah, that's true, too. And so the idea, though, in a funny way, is go back to the word fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
The word fear comes from the same root as fair, as like in thoroughfare. And the word fear actually means to go through it. And so that's why you have the old saying, what we're afraid of, we must one day walk towards. And so it's kind of like run towards the roar. What I'm afraid of is where I'm eventually going to have to go. And even though that may be scary, that's the right path. I also always, when I'm talking to young people, say, find the right trouble and commit to it. And what I mean is no one can escape the trouble now. It's all over the place. So the trick is to find the right trouble and go to work in solving problems in that area.
Absolutely.
I just want to let folks know, if they're just tuning in, we are talking with author and mythologist and storyteller and extremely accomplished man, Michael Mead, here this morning. It's 23 after 8. If you would like, if you have any questions for Michael, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. You can also contact us on Facebook at Positively Revolting and at Gmail at Positively Revolting. And I believe we are on the Twitter at Positive Revolt.
Indeed.
And I think that's all the social media identification we need, isn't it?
That's pretty much, that takes care of.
Okay.
Absolutely. And 503-231-8187 is the number to join us if you'd like to join in the conversation this morning.
Absolutely. So this lies thing these folks are doing, it's, I'm used to like really parsing out how politicians are lying. And this, of course, takes no intellectual prowess whatsoever. It's the most bald-faced lying I've ever seen. And you have an essay called Acts of Truth, and you tell a tale about the accumulated poison of lies. You want to, I thought.
Yeah. That's... So this level of lying is toxic, and it creates a spreading toxicity. It really is diminishing to oneself a sense of dignity and so on. And it's kind of an assault on the truth, and then it's turned into fake news, which is to say that anything we don't like is fake and is not true. And so it's the big lie, the old idea of tyranny is built upon the big lie. And you get this thing where a lot of people can't believe, no, they can't really be saying that there must be truth, some truth in it. No, not necessarily. And so again, I think it's a challenge to find the truth, to live the truth. I mean, on the public level, you know, journalists are going to have to figure out how to respond to this constant, you know, kind of, I don't even know what you call it.
Barrage.
Yeah, but the kind of compulsion of it is really hard to deal with also. So I have an essay coming out really soon where I went back to an old story that's actually in a Slavonic Russian folktale book. Notice the Russian connection. And and it's a story about the Tsar Trojan's ears. And so the idea about folktales and myths and all is they help us see deeper into what's going on, and they give us psychological insights, which I think are really helpful these days. Anyway, it turns out this another king who has the ears of a goat. He has goat's ears. And so he grows his hair in such a way as to cover the ears, you know, kind of a back comb, let's say. notice again
yes.
the similarity. This, you know, and so this is really an old story. And so, but every once in a while he needs a haircut, and so the barbers come in, and after they cut the hair, the king with the goat ears says, "Did you notice anything strange?" And the barber says, "Well, I did notice these goat ears." And so then he cuts their head off, and then he gets another barber the next time. So they start to run out of barbers, and so one master barber says, "Well, I'll send my apprentice because this looks dangerous." Notice the apprentice shows up. Like the similarities to the Donald Trump story is amazing. Anyway, the apprentice goes cut the hair. The king with the goat ears says, "Did you notice anything strange?" The apprentice is clever enough to say, "No, it all seems normal to me." So he becomes a royal barber. The problem is he has this secret, and he has to tell it eventually. That's how secrets tend to be. He goes back to his master barber and says, I have this secret. I need to tell someone." The barber says, "You can tell me, you could tell the local pastor, or you could dig a hole in the earth and yell it into the hole." And so he says, "I think I'll go with the earth hole approach." He digs a hole, yells three times into the earth. The king has of a goat, covers it up, and sure enough, he feels better. But then suddenly from that hole there grows an elder tree with very straight branches the local shepherds start cutting the branches to make flutes. And every time that they play the flute, what comes out is the emperor has the ears of a goat. And pretty soon the story is spread all over the place, and everybody realizes the emperor has the ears of a goat, and his hairdo is just covering it up. Eventually, of course, the emperor blames the apprentice for doing it and threatens him. The apprentice said, no, come and see, it was this tree and all this kind of stuff. And in the end, the emperor does not admit that he was telling lies all along, but he also doesn't slay the apprentice, and everyone knows the truth. So that helps me. It first of all tells me that, you know, it reinforces the idea that someone like Donald Trump, who is a profound narcissist, has a secret. The secret is there's no one inside there. There's a very, very small self that he kind of compensates for by claiming he's the only one that can do everything. And eventually that secret will become clear. The ineffectiveness will become manifest. But it's as if everybody has to psychologically understand what has happened here. A big mistake has occurred, and someone has been put in a very high position who is really a tyrant on a shaky internal throne. And that psychological information has to become known so that at least he can be removed. And then I like the idea that the earth begins to speak the truth. It comes from the earth creates the tree that creates the flute that creates the truth. And so as if we get more grounded, if we stay more in touch with our own earthiness, something like that, the truth will eventually spread far enough that a change will occur. And even though when that change occurs, we still have to be in the ground of our own truth to try and help build a more inclusive, a more just, and a more caring culture that also gets connected back to nature.
There's a lot to chew on there. There's a lot to chew on. Let's go ahead and talk to some of our callers. Good morning, Sunny. You're on the air.
Good morning. I think your guest puts the size and complexity of the problem well, and I appreciate your show, Ani and Lynn. I do not always agree, and sometimes I very agree, and I also enjoy the humor and wit and insight that you bring to things. I don't think I've ever had a chance to express that. I think one way to help is to make money, and I think now is a good time to put together T-shirts and coffee mugs with the Constitution on one side and the Bill of Rights on the other, so people really know this is what we've got, and it's something important to hold on to and to work with through these times. The other thing, let's be truthful, okay? We want to see things go right for everyone, but we also have to understand that a high amount of the antagonism that is going towards moving people out of this country is not that the majority are associated with it, but there is tonnage of meth and heroin coming out of Mexico. The Portland police just got a 90-pound bust of meth. And if you've had anyone hit by meth in your family or heroin or seen entire neighborhoods and blocks go down to it, it's terrible.
Sure.
But then what do you do? What do you do? When the jobs are gone, the drugs and the crime comes in. So if people want to make things better, they have to start growing their own economies that put everybody to work, because our country gave away most of its jobs and brought and allowed much drugs to come in.
Well, actually, not only allowed, Sonny, but I'm going to go ahead and interrupt you here and just go ahead and say, throughout the 80s, and likely before, but I'm most familiar with the 80s and onwards, you know, with the CIA actually benefiting and bringing in those drugs to flood the inner cities. It's the CIA working very hard to bring destructive means into the inner cities and to fund themselves and their illegal wars in Central America. And that's, you know, actually to look at a holistic picture. I think to blame any meth or heroin issues on immigrants or on people from Mexico is absolutely wrongheaded. I grew up in North Portland across the street from my house that was making meth just fine in and of itself. And they were white like me. So I'm just going to say we can do that domestically, and we have been since the 70s. So with that, let's go ahead and talk to Craig. All right, Craig, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for this program.
You're welcome.
I couldn't agree more that jobs is a major problem. I'm a grandfather, and I have also been engaged in discussions and activities and a practitioner of sustainable forestry for almost 40 years. And I can tell you that many of the efforts that are happening today are equating jobs and helicopters. They are not creating the kind of jobs that we desperately need. And without hope, people turn to drugs. We need to connect the dots. The denial, though, runs very, very deep, including in our systems of higher education, which, as one friend said, is mostly higher degrees are mostly about ritualized obedience that once led to privilege, but that privilege has been offshored and automated out of sight. So we have a system that's broken from the core, and until that we can really uncover those roots and rebuild from a basis of equality and freedom, as Michael Mead said, future generations have a snowball's chance. And I believe that this has happened on our watch, and we are culpable, all of us, and we need to do much better about being far more concerned about what we are leaving rather than what we are taking. Your comments?
Michael, do you want to address that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of good in there. And I think the idea of struggling against the lies and the use of the big lie, I think it has a lot of layers to it. In other words, jobs are a big problem. But I would also say the lack of meaningful work is a big problem.
Yeah.
And I think he was alluding partly to that. In other words, everybody should have a fair shot at a job. Level playing field is a really good idea. And once there's the equal opportunity, then what you want is truly awaken selves, that where people get to do meaningful work. That's also something where you come back from your effort and you feel that you have helped the forests, or you have made something beautiful, or you have made things more meaningful, or you've helped other people. So I always get a little worried when it's just jobs.
Yeah, I don't trust that.
Because, yeah, someone was saying, well, why don't we just go over to the people that elected Trump and talk about it and talk about bringing jobs back. And I agree at the level, the playing field level, yes, bring jobs back. Everybody deserves, you know, a chance at a healthy life. All this argument about health insurance is really, really strange. Everybody should have some assurance and some insurance that they have a chance to become themselves and to protect their family and all that kind of thing. And everybody does need a job, that's true. But I think if we're going to really fight for something, that we could go deeper and fight for meaningful work. And so the reason I wrote the genius myth was to try to say that everybody's born with a spark of genius. And if a person can live out that inner spark, which is also their orientation to life and the calling they might have, that right now, everybody's individual spark, everybody's imagination, everybody living closer to what they came to life to live for, would send people out to the forests and out to the rivers and out to help bring balance back to nature. And it would also send everybody out to all kinds of meaningful work. If we're going to struggle, I think once some level of honesty about jobs occurs, we should keep going and do something about meaningful work. And then understand the ideas about being afraid and maybe even angry at drugs coming in from wherever they might happen to be coming in from. But let's face it, there's another issue. Why do people want it so much? You know, in Mexico, they say, well, okay, you're trying to blame us for allowing it to come through or helping to come through the borders, but why is the demands for drugs so great in the place that calls itself the greatest place on earth? There is a really deep problem, someone mentioned there in the phone calls, when you lose hope, you turn to drugs. And my experience is that the word for losing hope is despair, desperare from the French. And my sense is that there's a level of despair right under the surface of the culture, which I think is connected to falling off the trail and getting caught in this kind of world of materialism and economics, which is important when you need food, important when you need work, but is not the whole of life. I think we're in a struggle for the imagination of human culture and for the soul of the world. And so, at least for me, when I see the increasing use of opioids and all, yes, some people are without jobs and you're sought to slip and fall into various holes and things. But I also think that there's a lack of awakened sense that each life is meaningful, and there's a lack of support, and often there's not the understanding that most people are wounded and need some kind of help healing those wounds and finding a deeper sense of self. I think, just again, I'll go back to the idea that Trump seems to be the symptom of the culture elevated to the top. The core idea, one of the core ideas of narcissism, is the person who is has a narcissistic disorder or a not great narcissistic pattern feels no inner sense of self, regardless of how much money they have, regardless of how much power they have. They need more. And so it's not simply the level of jobs. It's actually a deeper thing that might be a kind of wound in the American psyche. America doesn't really have a chance in the sense of being a protectionist nation. It is either the place where everybody can be welcome because we're going to fight for a meaningful dream, not the dream of materialism, but the dream of self-fulfillment. Regardless of the appearance of a person, there's a self in there that's imbued with genius, that came here to live a meaningful life. We're either going to fight for that, or we're going to get caught in some kind of a historical distortion and wind up severely divided. It's either diversity and unity from diversity, or it's going to be isolation against each other. I think that's the historical point where we're at.
Yeah. I can't really argue with that.
Absolutely. It is 8:42 in the morning. You are listening to KABU, your very own community radio station. Coming up at 9 o'clock, One Land, Many Voices looks at the death of the two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, the Pacific Underground crew shares their problematic favorites, those pop culture classics that were racist or offensive. They'll explore why we're drawn to them and the importance of media literacy. You don't want to miss that. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now. Take care of that embarrassing little problem. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You're listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are this morning talking with Michael Mead. If If people are interested in more of your work, Michael, where can they connect with you?
Mosaicvoices.org.
Mosaicvoices.org.
Yeah, and Mosaic Voices, which is now like 30 years old, the idea was we are a mosaic of voices. And only when all the voices find the place that they need to speak from and are heard by others do we have a real community. And so, you know, that's the basic idea. And but there at Mosaic Voices, they can find there's a podcast. And that goes out every week, and there's essays, and there's, you know, all the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say something, you know, I've been trying to figure out ever since the campaign and the election, you know, what to do. And,
yeah.
You know, again, I grew up, went through the 60s, was involved in the protest, all that kind of thing. And, but I was... What do I do now? And so what Mosaic has decided to do is, besides the usual, you know, evening presentations and so on, is to begin a series of community healing events. And the idea is to bring people together, not on that occasion simply to protest, but to be together in a meaningful way with each other, and to reinforce the sense that we are deeply connected and therefore don't have to be isolated, but also to activate each other into doing meaningful work and meaningful things. And so we've begun a series of community rituals that are intended to be healing, cohering, and activating. The idea being that not everybody's going to go out and do the same thing. There are people who are going to do more quiet things than a protest requires, and whatever it is, there, the diversity of meaningful actions is what, you know, creates meaningful change. And so we're eventually going to be doing that in Portland. But I'm mentioning it because I think there needs to be so many rooted, imaginative responses that we have to be so diverse in the manifestation of meaningful responses that we outplay the constant lies. The response to the series of lies can be found in the acts of truth. We need more. And the reason I say acts of truth is a bunch of old stories about how in the worst possible times, if a person lives and speaks something that's true in their life, from the root of their life, not just a belief or an agreement, but the living breath and expression of their life, you eventually defeat the kind of movement of lies.
All right, and let's go ahead. I totally agree.
I know we were sitting here. There's much head nodding going on, say, which is not good radio, but
that doesn't really work on radio. But Lynn and I are
nodding our heads.
Yes, and really without words. It's like, yes, that's exact. Yes, thank you. But we have to find our words now because we're on the radio. Let's go ahead and talk to Phil, shall we? Good morning, Phil. You're on the air.
Hello. It's a comment about what people are looking for. It's an old bread and roses. Where work, where you feel your spirit uplifted and your soul uplifted, and also repaying the earth and repaying for good deeds. And so, yeah, it's just an honor to talk to you folks. And Michael Meade's been a great wonder of a genius. And I'd just like to say, keep up the great work. And in these times, you definitely need folks like KBRU and community stations throughout the country telling us that there is a long struggle and a long memory, is what Utah Phillips would say.
Yeah.
That we've been doing this for a long time, and I'm sure we'll get through it all.
Thank you very much, Phil. And we have Joe as well. If you want to jump in, you may have time. Give it a whirl. Who knows? 503-231-8187. I can say that you can hear an archive of the show on kboo.fm/positivelyrevolting. It'll be posted just shortly after we get off the air. And you can also, of course, like us on Facebook, where you can find us, Positively Revolting, or in the Twitters, at Positive Revolt. And that That is all the many ways you can connect with us and to continue this conversation even throughout the week, because as we know, once a week is not enough. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you very much. Always enjoy the tone of your program, and it brings to mind probably something that I'd like to
do we have Michael. A tone?
We totally have a tone.
It's
B sharp.
I've heard 45 talk about the tone.
Something that is more heart opening and soft, and it brings out the conflict that I have and have had over the years, because I've been involved in protests. I was at the World Trade Organization. I was at the beginning of Occupy Portland. And way back during the Gulf War, my brother was returning from what was supposed to be this incredible battle with Saddam Hussein. And I remember being out at the tarmac at the Air Force Base with all these people chanting in this very surreal dead of night USA and then very patriotic slogans and showing support. And in all of these situations, I have this very deep, unsettled feeling around the anger and the gang feel of what happens with the energy. And so while I appreciate protest and think that we have to speak up, there's just something that is so difficult about fighting fire with fire in terms of the same kind of energy being hurled back at the loud voices that are trying to oppress us. So I'd love to hear some comment on that.
I think that's a fascinating issue, actually, because I found myself really feeling quite a lot of anger, and I feel like it's an anger that's deeply based in love. And I would actually love to hear what Michael has to say about that. You know, the anger that is displayed when, say, a mother bear feels like her cub is threatened. That's not really a gentle response, but it's, you know, based in that wanting very much to protect what is precious. And sometimes I feel like anger is an appropriate response, but it's anger coming from that place of deeply wanting to protect and preserve. Michael, what do you have to say?
Well, a couple of things. Anger and rage are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Rage is blind and it destroys things. So that's when the anger has turned to rage, that's when you get the violence. And that's why, you know, sometimes protest destroys things when it was trying to preserve something.
Mm-hmm.
Anger is, theorists say, the deepest emotion in the human psyche, in the sense that, just like you said about the mother bear, anger is about self-protection. Anger is about resetting boundaries. And so I love the idea of satyagraha, the Gandhi's phrase, that when you're going to take a stand against something as big as the British Raj or something as big as an imperialistic colonial government, you have to act, he called it satyagraha, the force of truth. So we're back to the act of truth. And so he led that pilgrimage across India that brought down the whole British Raj. And I think we have to have that kind of imagination and the idea of nonviolent protest, which is really easy to say and really hard to do. I know from personal experience, when you're in the front line where the two forces are meeting, it's really hard, you know, to not get pulled into the basic reaction of anger and attack. And so I think there needs to be these bigger principles, and I think Gandhi stands in history as one of the examples.
And the water keepers at Standing Rock, to me, are also an example of that.
Exactly. And when the veterans came to protect the water keepers and all the native people there, that was a move. The warrior is, the true warrior is the last one to go to war. Warrior means to serve something greater than oneself in a disciplined way. And so when I think back to the 60s, one of the things that was missing more often than not was what you might call elders, people who had lived through some stuff, had survived some stuff, and understood a little bit deeper that just being angry or just flashing off could actually create more damage. And so...
Well, we weren't supposed to trust anybody over 30 in those days.
That's true.
I was there too.
but now we're way over 30.
So we're so really... Trustable.
Can we trust ourselves?
No, certainly not.
But it might be more now about can we protect people under 30?
Yeah.
And, you know, so hopefully there might be some growth in terms of learning how best to do things. But I just love this phrase, satyagraha, move with the force of truth. And then I think of the old, you know, the Keats poem, you know, beauty is truth, and truth is beauty. And that's all you know and all you need to know. And in that sense, if it isn't making the world more beautiful, and that doesn't mean peaceful and quiet. It just means more beautiful, mm-hmm. more rich, more full, more humane and human in the moment, maybe it's not the best move to make. I mean, it's a hard ideal. But I think the ideals are worth struggling for. It doesn't mean people don't make mistakes. But mm-hmm. I think there really is an issue about, moving with something that keeps me feeling that I'm close to my own truth and the ground of truth. And finding a capacity to really stand for something and not collapse into a kind of a distortion of the truth.
I know that's what I worry about, the new normal, that people will start thinking of these lies and buffoonery as the new normal. Like, we have to, as you say, get used to it, but you have to keep your center and know what truth is.
Yes, and I think truth always has a psychological level. That's why I'm using all these stories about what's wrong with those in power, that we have to have a psychological capacity, for instance, to understand that when someone is as narcissistically shaped as Donald Trump, they will lie continuously. You can show all the facts you want, because the big lie is that there is no active self-caring essence there. I mean, it's valuable to know that. How could someone be? It's not just foolish. It's a complex, and it's a disorder. And understanding that, I think, helps not take the bait so much. And then I still think it also does speak of a need to heal America's cultural collective sense of superiority. The issues in the world are so big, who cares who thinks they're the most powerful nation on earth? How about who cares enough about the earth to use power effort to make the earth more protected itself? And so there's a way in which I think becoming psychologically aware is also helpful. And psychology is useful when if you happen to be on the front line or you are faced with a potentially violent situation. It's really helpful to know one's own psyche and to have psychological moves, because I've been there enough to know that the police on the other side, they're trapped too, generally speaking. And you know, in other words, they're sent out to do the duty that the state requires, and right now the state is increasingly unjust, and so they're all caught in a position where they have to pretend or act from a basis of injustice, and some of them can feel that, and you know, there's a way to maybe bring that out, mm-hmm. so we don't just get caught in us and them. And the enemy's going to battle again.
Yeah, let them know there's a place for them at our table. A place, not a controlling place, but a place.
Well, because the police really are an expression of this idea of the warrior. Some of them understand that. And the warrior serves justice, not the law. The warrior serves something beyond themselves. And you saw some of that, you know, in Standing Rock, the idea that we're going to stand for a greater justice, even though we have a capacity to be violent or to be, you know, physically engaged that way.
Of course, Standing Rock's the actions there.
To imagine that there are ideals, even on even existing with the people that we don't don't agree with.
Yeah, we are out of time, and so I don't even know how to wrap up. There's so much to
thank
chew
you,
on.
Michael.
There is just so much to chew on. Michael Mead, thank you very much for joining us again. For folks wanting to find out more about Michael's work, you can find it at mosaicvoices.org. Michael, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Audie. Good luck to both you and everybody listening.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for your work. And with that, we make way now for One Land, Many Voices, coming right up. Continue to listen to KBOO. We'll be back next week.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock a.m. And as promised, One Land, Many Voices is coming right up right after these important announcements, so stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the August Wilson Monologue Competition Regional Finals on Monday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at the Newmark Theater in Portland. 12 Portland area high school students will perform monologues from August.